To get back to Nelson Mandela, he was one of the people, and she had met him on a number of occasions, and we invited him and he came, which was unreal. And I remember being out at the airport to meet him when he got off the flight, and the sense of love.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today is Mary Davis, who has recently retired as Chief Executive Officer of Special Olympics International. The Mayo woman led the team that brought the Special Olympics to Ireland in 2003, the first time it was hosted outside the United States. She has also served on the Irish Council of State, and she contested the presidential election in 2011, an experience she has described as tough but mainly positive. Mary Davis, you're very welcome to the Insights podcast. What
Thank
an
you, Sean.
Interesting
Thank you very
much. And valuable life and career you've had. How are you adjusting to life back in Ireland? You spent, 10 years in Washington, D.C.?
That's right, John. Thank you for having me on as well, the podcast. I appreciate it. I was 10 years in D.C. the end of 2015. I left Ireland to take up the position of the chief executive, the global CEO, as it was called then. So, yeah, I thought that I'd be able to, you know, come over and back a couple of weeks in Washington, D.C., a couple of weeks back in Ireland. But, of course, once I took on the job, it did not end up like that. And I spent the majority of my time in the U.S., certainly until COVID. And then I was back in Ireland. And then, of course, COVID did change the way we all do our work. I think people are probably trying to get back now to traditional methods of working, coming into the office 5 days a week. But it wasn't certainly straight after COVID. So it was more possible to spend a little bit more time in Ireland. Although my preference would have been to be in Ireland full time, of course, but my preference for the job was I was better able to serve the organisation from Washington.
Have you been, or have you found it easy, Mary, to let go? Because you're a few months out of it now.
I have. I finished work on the 31st of December. And honestly, Sean, I have not looked back. I've been incredibly busy since then doing, don't ask me, I don't know what. I say that to my friends. I say, I don't know why there aren't enough hours in the day to do all the things that I want to do.
Might have something to do with maybe grandchildren and children.
It could be. It could be. Mum, are you free on the 14th of the month or whatever? You know, there's that. And there's a desire. You know, it's one of the reasons that I decided to. I didn't have to retire. I could have stayed on and worked for another 10 years as global
until you
CEO.
Were what, over 80? I mean, that's the American way, isn't it?
Even more I could have. And I mean, Eunice Kennedy Shriver herself never ever retired, and her son keeps telling me this, Timothy, who was my boss, he was the chairman, but he kept saying, you know, we had a wonderful working relationship. We got on extremely well. I valued him and he valued me for what I did, and I think he would have been very happy if I were to continue in the job. But home was calling. You know, I'd been away for 10 years. It was tough on my husband, Julian. He was coming over and back. I mean, once he retired himself, he retired during COVID, it was a little bit easier because he was able to leave. And he had a passion for Washington, D.C., actually, which I was ever grateful for. He loves reading. He's an enthusiastic reader, politics, history, all biking. And we both had bikes there. So we had a fabulous time on the trails at the weekend. So that made it a little bit easier when he retired. But before that, it was quite difficult. We didn't see each other very much. And of course, our children, we have four adult children now, as they developed and got married or had partners and had children, I was missing out on moments of birth, etc.
And of course, I mean, Special Olympics really, it has dominated. It's been your life for what, almost 4.5 decades, maybe even longer, right back to the late 70s. Yeah. You just got stuck into it, or drawn into it, maybe a better way of putting it, not long out of college.
Yeah, 47 years actually been involved. Yeah, straight out of college. I was a teacher, I was a physical education teacher. I got a couple of subbing jobs initially. It was the time in Ireland too, it was in the late 70s. It wasn't easy to pick up a job in teaching. So did a few subbing jobs. And then I got a job in St. Michael's House, and that was really the start of it. So I was working in St. Michael's House. Special Olympics was just coming to Ireland then, having started in the States in 1968, came to Ireland in 1977-78. And I was one of the sort of founding members there at the time, who together with a group of very enthusiastic people, passionate about change for people with intellectual disability, or actually probably called mental retardation, but I'll come back to that again, at the time. But, you know, we really got stuck in. And as it so happened, my husband, Julian, also took a job with St. Michael's House. So he worked on the south side and I worked on the north side, because they had about 22 services, day services around Dublin and the greater Dublin area. So we used to meet up and figure out how on earth we were going to run the programme, how are we going to do it, because we were never taught in college, you know, how to break down skills for somebody that might not have reached that ability of playing sport as we know it. And so we spent a lot of time together and obviously developed a liking for each other through that, and eventually in 1980 got married.
And Special Olympics, it's about presumably finding ways for people with limited maybe physical or mental abilities to find a sport or an activity that works for them. Is that a fair way of putting it?
That is a fair way of putting it. I mean, it is an organisation that that promotes ability, that promotes inclusion. When I started out as well, it was very much an organisation for people with intellectual disability. And by that I mean, you know, we provided training opportunities, we provided skill development, etc. And we, in doing all that, it grew the confidence and the self-esteem of people with the intellectual disability. And then there were the various different games, whether it was at local level or national games, that they were able to go on and participate, and ultimately international games. And it was very much about that. The biggest shift probably that I've seen in Special Olympics over those years and now for the past number of years is the shift to not just for, we still are an organisation for in the services we provide, but an organisation from which other people can learn a great deal. So the general public, how can we change attitudes? How can we ensure that people are truly included in the communities in which they live and in society in general? So that's quite a big shift. And now we spend a lot of our time and resources on changing mindsets of young people, of service providers, etc., whether that's in health, education, leadership, whatever, as well as...
Yeah, because Mary, one of the things I was reading prior to this conversation was that people with intellectual disabilities, they can be subject to bullying, and that maybe is something that might surprise people at this stage, maybe less so a few decades ago, but it still seems to be something that requires a lot of work and attention.
It's a big issue. It's still a big issue. I don't know about here in Ireland, but I'm sure it does exist, but certainly in the US and in many other countries around the world, bullying is an issue, because these young people or elderly people are different. They have different needs, is how I like to put it, rather than even they're disabled. They have different needs. And we all have, God knows, we all have different needs as well. So yeah, bullying in schools in particular amongst young people. So to combat that, we introduced a program called Unified Champion Schools, UCS. And really what we do is bring people with and without intellectual disability together in an atmosphere of play. So it's through sport, through Special Olympics, where they get to know each other, they get to understand each other, they get to respect each other. And we've done quite a bit of research into this, and we did some research with Harvard a couple of years ago to see how we could adapt our teaching, what we could do to ensure that we were achieving what we wanted to achieve, which was not just to have the athletes fit and healthy and participating in sport, but participating with their non-disabled peers as well, and in so changing the mindset of those young people. And what we found that if we could teach things like universal dignity, empathy, perspective taking, moral courage, that if we could teach those things and include them in our curriculum, then that would, the research tells us that that would change the mindset of young people. And you do see it, because if you take moral courage, what happens? It's not that the young person, I think, or the child wants to be nasty, but they don't really know any better. They're not educated to understand people that are different from them. So they act in this sort of, you know, way, aggressive way in many ways. And no, everybody else is afraid to stand up to them. You know, they're just afraid. And that's what happens with bullying.
And is part of the skill as well that you impart or work towards, that you give people the tools, if they're the subject of the bullying, to deal with it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. We also obviously train them as well in how to deal with it. But our emphasis is more specifically on the person without the disability, so that they're more empathetic, so that they're more understanding, so that they see it from the other person's perspective.
And where is that program set out, or how is it transmitted?
It's transmitted through schools in the main. Yeah, well, there's about 10,000 schools in the US that are currently have the program. The US is funded by the Department of Education as well, which is really critical to ensuring the sustainability and the resilience of the program. But around the world, there's also about 30,000 schools around the world. And what's holding us back? Because we would today, we would love every single school to have a unified program in their schools. But basically, it is funding, and it is opportunities and getting into schools. And, you know, oftentimes we have to give a stipend, some sort of a grant to encourage the schools to get involved in the program. And that's where the funding comes from in the US, from the US government.
Those numbers you just mentioned a few moments ago, Mary, 10,000 schools in the US, 30,000 additional ones around the world. Give me an idea as to the scale of Special Olympics at this stage worldwide.
Well, we're in 175 plus programs in the world. We have about 5 million athletes. We had more pre-COVID, but sadly we lost a lot of athletes through COVID, and we're trying to build that back now stronger and better, and have been doing since we came out of COVID. So we have about 5 million athletes at the moment, and We offer a huge program. I mean, people often associate Special Olympics with the big games. Oh, I'm always asked, when are the next games? And of course, there will be next games, and there are games every second year, because we have winter games, apart from when they had to be cancelled during COVID as well. And we have summer games. So alternatively, every not unlike the Olympics, and I think it's the year before the Olympics. But we try to serve our population in so many other ways, and also serve the general population in terms of the things I talked about, the work we're doing in schools. So we have that very comprehensive schools program. We have a very, very comprehensive health program, probably one of the biggest catering for people with intellectual disability in the world. So we do a lot of work in the health space in terms of prevention through nutrition education and physical activity, etc., through assessments and screenings that we do at all World Games. We would have a whole setup, like a medical, huge medical centre set up in 9 various different
disciplines. But I'm wondering as well, say, you know, on a week-to-week or month-to-month basis, in between those big occasions, what kind of engagement does an individual athlete or somebody who's in contact and benefiting from your service, what kind of, what do they get, or how frequent is the contact?
Yeah, they can achieve those services at local level as well. It's not just at international level. We do it on a bigger scale, obviously. You know, but you'll find, say, here in Ireland, in communities, they would have screenings. You know, so the programme is offered. It's very much built at local level. So we have local level programs. So that would be in clubs or in schools or in daycare centres or wherever. Wherever we can start a programme, really, mainly through a lot of clubs here in Ireland and working closely with national governing bodies of sport as well.
And are there upper age limits on participation, or can anybody of any age be involved?
Anybody of any age, yeah. We've had over 80-year-olds compete. And there are activities like walking activities, softball throw, golf, activities like that that we can all carry on into our mature age. So these are all activities that we offer for our athletes as well, so that they can shift from maybe a more active sport like gymnastics or something that they are basketball that they've been involved in to sports to accommodate their age and ability as well. So there's no upper age limit, and now there's no lower limit, in a sense that we do a lot of early intervention programs now, child and mother programs to introduce mothers and families to Special Olympics once the child is born. It's a relatively new program, the last sort of 10-12 years, but we are developing that now and see the importance of that, because if you start young, like everything, you're going to be motivated to continue and to introduce parents and families to the benefits of an involvement with Special Olympics as well.
I heard an interview you did with one of your colleagues in Special Olympics, Novi Craven, on a Special Olympics podcast, and she asked you about your highlight, you know, in terms of the World Games you were at, and I was expecting you to say pretty well immediately, "Oh, the 2003 Games in Dublin," but actually there was one that you mentioned before that, because you had a particular reason for remembering it. I think it was it in South Bend, in Indiana.
Yes. Yeah, I was hoping I was going to remember what I'd said, to be honest, Sean, when you asked me that question. But yes, it was in South Bend, Indiana. So when I started working in the whole area in Ballymun, there was a person, with intellectual disability on the south side, actually, where my husband, my now husband, worked. And he knew I had passion for gymnastics. I loved gymnastics and really got into the coaching side of it at the weekends and as a volunteer with Special Olympics. Because, of course, I was a volunteer for 10 years and I continued to teach. But anyway, he said to this girl, Rita Lawler, "Should come go over," and Mary runs a club on a Saturday morning, "just go over and see what you think." So Rita came, and honestly, I have never seen anybody more enthusiastic, more passionate, more willing to learn and to want to know more and to want to live ultimately in the community. And at that stage, she lived in sheltered accommodation and she worked in a sheltered workshop. So she came over anyway, and she worked so hard over the years, and she qualified for the games in South Bend in Indiana. And lo and behold, she won the all-around, which was like for a number of disciplines. I can't remember exactly at the time. She won the gold medal. Well, I was her coach, and really, you know, for her and for everybody associated with her, it was just fantastic. And it changed her life completely, completely. Like, Rita now is living independently in an apartment or a flat in Ruhini. I see her quite often. We meet up, we'll meet up more regularly now that I'm back. But every time I came home, I would see Rita for a cup of coffee. So she was able to do that. She was able to, you know, with help and support services, she's able to manage her own finances, everything to do with the apartment as well. She's very integrated into the community. She goes to a fitness club down the road in Ruhini. She's well known in the area because she likes to chat and to talk and to find her way around by herself. She's very independent, always had that streak to be independent, and rightfully so, of course. She and many others like her should have that sense of independence. And she wrote a book called Moving On, which now that I have more time, I must look for it and find a copy of it, because I'd love to sort of go through it.
You also said in that conversation that people who are involved in Special Olympics, who volunteer, you will become a different person.
Absolutely. Totally. I did. Anybody I ever talk to will say it's not, because, you know, some people say, aren't you great? You know, the work you do. No, I'm not great. I do a job. I love what I do. I adore it. And I get so much more out of it, so much more in terms of satisfaction at seeing the transitions of people. When you do provide a service like we provide, and when you do try to change the mindsets of people. I remember a parent saying to me, she had a son with Down syndrome, and she said, I wouldn't change my son for the world, but I would change the world for my son. And that's what we try to do. Mm-hmm. Actually, every day, I and thousands and thousands of others, and volunteers particularly, try to change the world for the better for people who may seem different, but really aren't different. They're the same needs, same wishes, same desires. They're better swimmers than most of us. You know, they can do a lot of things that others can't do.
We have, of course, this big Special Olympics event coming up in Ireland in June. That's a national event. So presumably your advice to anybody thinking or wondering should they get involved, you'd say go for it.
Oh, absolutely go for it, for sure. And we saw that so much in 2003 when we organised the World Special Olympic Games. Here we had 30,003. To be exact, volunteers who came and worked for free day in, day out, and each and every one of them would say it was a mind-blowing, changing their lives experience, and the impact that it had on them as people, and what many of them went on to do afterwards in terms of volunteering, maybe not just for Special Olympics, but for other or not-for-profit organisations that needed help as well.
I remember being at the opening ceremony in Croke Park. You had Muhammad Ali, you had Nelson Mandela. How did you manage to get them here for that? I mean, that was real star quality, let it be said.
A stroke of luck, Sean, is what I can say. I mean, we were so fortunate. Nelson Mandela was a great supporter of Special Olympics, and he and Eunice Kennedy
I figured there was Kennedy magic involved in this.
Yeah, there was, of course there was. Eunice didn't leave a stone unturned when it came to finding the best services, the best opportunities, the best people that could promote Special Olympics in the world. She never stopped. She was rest. She had this incredible sense of restlessness and wanting to do better and everybody to be as good as they could possibly be. And she promoted that at every level, at local level, with individuals that I see that still work in Special Olympics with special needs. But anyway, to get back to Nelson Mandela, he was one of the people, and she had met him on a number of occasions, and we invited him and he came, which was unreal. And I remember being out at the airport to meet him when he got off the flight, and the sense of love that he sort of exudes and happiness and joy for somebody that was confined for that many years and went through so much trauma. I mean, his positive attitude on life, his humility, the glint in his eye, the fun that you could see there in that man was just unbelievable. It was great. So to have him and to have somebody that really promoted unity more than diversity all his life, it was very, very special.
And what was it like when he and Ali got together?
Oh, fun. They were like, you know, box shadow boxing.
Of course, Mandela was a boxer.
Yeah, exactly. So they were just fun to be around. And Muhammad Ali as well. Like, I had met him years before that. I think it must have been at a Games in 1983 in Louisiana, I think it was. And he was there, of course, by the younger man, you know, able to chat and talk and have fun. And I only spent a couple of minutes with him then. I was determined to meet him, though. And then to meet him all those years later in Ireland, and that he never missed an event while he was in the country. You know, he went to all the activities. He was fully supportive of what we were doing, and so much so that even when he was on his way to the airport, we had an event out just across from the airport. Can't remember which event. Oh, it was floor football, I think, at the time. In the National Show Centre it was at the time. But he insisted on stopping off on his way to the airport to see the athletes, which in itself created a scene, because he required the use of a wheelchair at that stage, and we didn't have any in and also a golf buggy too was what we were going to transport him around in. Well, one of the volunteers, God bless whoever it was, went to the local golf shop, got on, said, "We're taking this, whether you like it or not. We need this down in the show centre." And against the power of the volunteers and the lengths that they will go to, I mean, so that when the car pulled up, the golf buggy was there for he to transfer into. So amazing.
I said in the intro that it was the first time the Special Olympics World Games happened outside the United States. Now, was that something that they, by which I mean, or by whom I mean, Eunice Kennedy, they wanted to expand? Or did you see something that said to you, look, we got to get this outside of America and we got to start in Ireland?
It was a bit of both. I mean, they wanted to expand the organisation for sure, to have as many countries as possible, that it wasn't also perceived as solely a US programme, which in many cases today it is still perceived in many places around the world as a US programme. But anyway, of course, it started in the US. But so it was a bit of that, but a bit of us saying, you know, well, we're at the stage where we can do this. And we did it not so much to bring a big event to Ireland and to have tourism and all that sort of thing. That all may well have happened. But we did it to improve the Special Olympics program, to make it bigger, to make it better, to create more opportunities for people with special needs. And, you know, at that stage, there were families in Donegal. I remember talking to one mother, and she would say, oh, it takes us an hour on a bus to get to where we need to train the athletes. We have an hour training and an hour back. 3 hours round trip every week or twice a week to have their son or daughter participate in a training program, Special Olympics, and compete. That, I didn't like that. I was the chief executive of Special Olympics at Ireland at the time, and I thought, we have to do something to make that easier. We need to bring the program closer to the people. But again, it's resources and opportunities and people and volunteers and so many other things that build a community like Special Olympics.
How long a lead-in time did you have for the World Games coming here?
We had 4 years. So we started bidding 4 years. So, yeah, we were in Connecticut, I think it was, at the Games. And well, that's when we started to bid, because Connecticut was 1995 and 1999 was North Carolina. So in Connecticut, we had the idea. And really, it was talking to people like Fergus Finley at the time, whose daughter Mandy had qualified for the World Games, and she was participating in basketball. And we were at the event, and we had said, a bunch of us had sort of said, yeah, we could do this. And then we were talking to Fergus, and he said, well, would you ever think about doing it? And we said, yeah, it's funny. We were just talking about it and saying, yeah, that it's something that we could do, that we could give our best shot, let's say. Well, so he then was Labour Party was in government at the time, Dick Spring, and
yeah, he was a key advisor,
and Julie O'Neill was his Secretary General at the time, or Assistant Secretary probably. But anyway, so we came back and the wheels began to turn by Fergus introducing us to all those people, and to Julie O'Neill as well, who was key, as it happened, and Dick Spring and many others in government who helped to support the bid and set up a steering committee to put the bid together, which we did and submitted that. And now Eunice Kennedy was known to say, Ireland, that, you know, a small island on the edge of Europe, and it rains all the time there. Not so sure about that. So it wasn't, you know, people say, oh, because of the Kennedys and the American and the connection, the Irish
connection.
She
was a skeptic, was she, at the start?
She wasn't going to give over easily, let's say. She certainly wasn't. But anyway, we presented her with a raincoat in 2021 and said, you know, you'll be fine. And the funny thing was, you know, it didn't rain once in Ireland during those
One of the great memories of that is it wasn't just Dublin or big cities. The whole country seems to have gotten engaged with it.
Yeah, yeah. That was the wonderful thing, the mobilisation of the entire island of Ireland. Because
and every town could make a contribution,
every
practically.
Town. We had 165 countries that came, and we had 165 plus towns and villages across the island of Ireland that took people or volunteered to host our athletes from around the world in their homes, in their homes, which was incredible. We've had host town programs before, but the athletes have stayed in hotels and communities and stuff like that, never in homes. This was like in houses. So can you imagine now the general public that would not necessarily have had any interaction with intellectual disability in the past, now having four people or five people living in their homes. It was transformative. It just transformed Ireland in such a way, and the attitudes and the positive feeling towards the abilities of people with special needs. And many of them came, they had really hadn't planned to come and support the athletes when they were competing in their competitions, which were mainly based in Dublin and in Belfast as well. We had skating in Belfast, and we had some other fringe events in Belfast as well, because we wanted it to be an all-island event. We didn't want it to be just OA Games in the city of Dublin. So we never spoke about it in those terms at all, and it was great.
How many Special Olympic clubs would there be in this country?
I would say it's about 250, 260 clubs. There was 400 at one stage. I think a lot of clubs were lost during COVID, and they, like every other country, is trying to build back.
That was a particularly challenging time for you when you were based in Washington. It was not something that anybody saw coming, although I suppose statistically, you know, once in a century, an event like that is probably due. How did you contend with it?
With great strength and resilience is what I would say. It was a very difficult time. It was a very challenging time. You know, once we were told that things were closing down and we couldn't get into the office anymore, and we couldn't have any events, and we couldn't have any training, that was like, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? What are our athletes? Like, how are we going to adapt and to change so quickly? So that was the first thought. Our athletes, both safety of our athletes, who were compromised in many ways due to other, other things that they had going on. That was difficult. So how we were going to do that, but how we were going to provide a service for them as well. So that was the first thing that came to our minds. The second thing was finances. I mean, what was going to happen? Everybody was suffering now. There wasn't going to be the same amount of money around. Were we going to have the funds to continue? Were we going to have to lay off staff? What were we going to do? So those were the two sort of uppermost things in my mind. And I remember sitting in my apartment and just spending hours on the phone. And of course, Zoom became the big thing for everybody then. But for me, we had been using Zoom for a very long time before that, because we're a global organization. And the only way that you could stay in touch with everybody was through Zoom. So we did that. We got together all my senior team and anybody else that could help us to navigate through the challenges that we were facing. And we pivoted very quickly, actually. And we got a lot of help from, Microsoft, other organizations that helped us with the technology end of things, and we were able to provide a service online, albeit watered down in comparison with the actual physical contact, which of course our athletes benefit from as well as the training opportunities. But we did training programs and fitness programs, and we organized webinars once a month for everybody, for the entire programs around the world came together to share what they were doing. And we had athletes' voices being heard through those webinars as well. And at the same time, we were advocating for vaccines. When the vaccine came on train, we were had to advocate for that, because there were some places and countries that were favouring others over people who were different or people with intellectual disability. So we were advocates and fighting for that.
For fair distribution.
For fair distribution, absolutely. Why not? Why there should be equal distribution? Why should another person be treated differently than somebody else?
But from what you were saying just a few minutes ago, Mary, that it seems that the organisation hasn't fully made up the ground at last.
No.
Beginning, 6 years ago? And it went on for, 2 years to all intents and purposes?
Yeah, 2 years it went on. And even after that, there were still issues around participation in public events and activities, which we had lots of struggles with, particularly in Florida, when we tried to organise the US Games there. And we had Governor DeSantis on our back because we were insisting that people were vaccinated, and he didn't see any need for it. It wasn't going to happen in his state. So he levied us with a $27 million fine at one stage because they were charging people. It was unbelievable. That was another very traumatic time in the organisation, I have to say.
How did you deal with that?
With the same strength and agility and patience that we dealt with COVID when it happened. It wasn't easy.
Strength, agility and patience. What about a bit of toughness, steeliness?
There was that too. There was that too. We had to be, because we had to stand up for what we believed in. And we believed that it was absolutely important that our population, because they were compromised, that they needed to have a vaccine and that they should have a vaccine if we were going to meet up. There were
What was the upshot? What did DeSantis collect?
The upshot, he didn't. The upshot, we came to an agreement through various collaborative efforts, getting many, many people involved. Tim, again, my boss, the chairman, was very involved in all of that with myself and others, the board as well. We have a very astute group of board members, senior people from Bank of America and from various different walks of life who all got stuck in, got involved, helped us to navigate.
That's a suitable moment, I think, for me to go back a little bit, because I didn't ask you how you ended up as Chief Executive of Special Olympics. Were you headhunted?
I was. So I had been asked to, would I be interested in the job before that, before I took it on. And I knew I would have to ultimately move to DC, and I didn't feel like it was the right time anyway to do that. You know, I had our youngest son, I think, was still in college, finishing off his degree and stuff, and I just felt it wasn't the right time. And I was quite happy at that stage. I was the president and managing director of Special Olympics Europe Eurasia. I had 58 countries that I was looking after. A ton of work to be done there. Tons of work still to be done there. And so I was quite content. I was able to, we had to move our headquarters from Brussels to Dublin and operate from there, which was great. So, I said at that stage, no. So they hired another CEO then, and for whatever reasons, that really didn't seem to work out as well as everybody thought that it would. So I was approached again then to go. And at that stage, then things were slightly different in terms of our home situation. So we discussed it as a family and decided, why not? Sure, you know, you'd probably be great to be in that position and to have the opportunity not just to change minds and hearts in Ireland or in Europe, but also globally. Mm. You know, and there are so many issues in Africa and, you know, many other countries in Asia Pacific and East Asia to be tackled. Mm. So, I felt the time was right. So, yeah, Julian agreed and off I went.
The political context, of course, has changed over the years. I mean, you went there in 2015. I think it was towards the end of the Barack Obama presidency. Mm. And then came Trump won that period, 2016 to 2020. How does that affect the job you do, or how did it affect the job that you were doing?
Well, most governments in the US have been very supportive of Special Olympics, and whether you were Democratic or Republican, there's a lot of support for Special Olympics in the US. So governments down through the years, although they changed, were very supportive, and Barack Obama and the US government then were very supportive. I think he organized an event. Most presidents would organize some sort of an event in the White House to celebrate Special Olympics. And I know President Clinton did. Barack Obama, I think he did. I'm not 100% sure. And then the first Trump era, well, there were a couple of things. He was supportive in many ways, but on the other hand, I think he was very much of the belief that organisations like Special Olympics should be privately funded, not publicly funded. So I think there was a bit of an issue there with himself and the then Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, who felt like maybe we shouldn't be getting funding in education, and tried to stop that. Well, I think they learned very quickly because there was uproar amongst many communities, whether no matter what the political, because we're an apolitical mm-hmm. organization anyway, that were up in arms against that. So that was reversed. Yeah. And since then, the funding has never ever been touched.
Even when Elon Musk landed in last year with his famous chainsaw?
No. Special Olympics was not touched.
Right. And I think when you had the Winter Games last year, was it in Italy? You had the presence of, was it the Vice President was there with
Mrs.
his
Vance.
Wife? Yeah.
Mrs. Vance was there. And Mrs. Pence had been to previous games as well. We had the 2019 games were in Abu Dhabi, and two people that were there were Mrs. Karen Pence and the now Secretary in Education, Linda McMahon, from WWE fame. So they were both at the games, so they saw the benefits and the importance. And usually there would be a presidential party that would attend the games. So yes, in Turin then we had Mrs. Vance. And actually President Trump, after those games that Linda McMahon and Karen Pence had been to in Abu Dhabi, invited Special Olympics athletes and myself to the Oval Office to meet with him, and he wanted to show his appreciation and celebrate the abilities and the talents and the gifts of the athletes.
So how did that go?
That went well. I mean, I was a bit, oh my goodness, like we're going to the Oval Office. And it was very strict in the sense we were told there'll be no speeches. There'll be just one presentation by an athlete that will make the presentation, and Mrs. Pence will speak, and that's it. So it was fine. We were very relaxed, just going along. And we were brought, first of all, to meet Mrs. Pence and Mike Pence as well. So we met them in his office, and that was very relaxed, very easy. And then we went over to the Oval Office, and the president was there, and he was very welcoming towards the athletes. And once he found out they played golf, he just pivoted straight away. And he was able to engage with them and ask them questions. So he felt very comfortable as well. And so much so then as he turned to me, so Mrs. Pence spoke and the athlete did the presentation, and then he turned around and he said, and now Mary, we'll have a few words from you. Well, Sean, I froze on the spot. I thought, I wasn't expecting this. But anyway, I got over it, no problem. So it was fine.
Can you remember any of what you said?
Extraordinary. I'm sure I talked. I'm sure I thanked them profusely for their support, and also I think I talked about the change that bringing the World Games to Abu Dhabi meant as well, because it did. It opened up a whole new world there of understanding and acceptance and reaching out. And the Crown Prince got so involved, and he's now the president of the UAE, but he got so involved in the games, and he really was passionate about young people understanding the gifts of these special people.
As somebody, okay, you're not in the executive position any longer, but who has a very acute sense of what's happening in the world, how do you view the impact, for instance, of the wars that are going on in the Middle East as we're recording this, and also between Ukraine and Russia? How would they, or how might they impact, presumably in a detrimental way, on Special Olympics?
Absolutely. Detrimental. It's terrible. It really is. Mm. You know, the war in Ukraine, well, the program in the Ukraine had struggled and struggled and struggled. It was very, very difficult for them. We supported them 100%. But also, you know, in Russia, and, you know, I obviously don't agree with Russia invading Ukraine, but disability is disability wherever it is in the world. And it's our job to support and to improve the lives of people with intellectual disability, no matter where they are or who they are. And as I mentioned, we're apolitical in that sense. Mm-hmm. So we continue to, in the best possible way that we could, support the program in Russia. We were due to have the games, the Winter Games that were cancelled. We were due to have them in Kazan. This was before the invasion and before COVID. We had started the planning. And there was huge warmth for the program for Special Olympics and for giving opportunities to their people with special needs. And we got just great receptions every time we went there, whether it was to Moscow to meet some government officials, or to Kazan to meet organizers and stuff. So that would have had an enormous impact, just like hosting games in Ireland had huge impact on the island of Ireland. Yeah. The same would have happened in Russia, but sadly it didn't happen because of COVID at the time. And the Middle East, same thing though, Sean. You know, there are so many countries now affected that have that are challenged in terms of what they can offer in terms of their programming. And that is very, very sad to see.
I said at the very start that you had contested the presidential election here in 2011, that you found it to be a mainly positive experience, one that toughened you up. What are your thoughts about that now when you look back?
Well, it was an experience. I mean, you know, it was in the main, it was a positive experience as well. I mean, I suppose I got most joy out of travelling around the country. Mm. The people I met at the time, and the whole reason I decided to put my name forward was because, as you know, we'd had the downturn, we'd had the crash, we'd had everything. And, you know, there was a lot of sadness around, and difficult for young people particularly to get work. You know, I didn't know, we had our own young family at the time who were trying to get into employment. Their friends were immigrating to Canada, they were immigrating to Australia, London. Our two girls went to London, which is not so far away, and ever grateful that that's the case, because it's a handy skip now over to see the grandchildren and to see them. But at the time, that was very tough. It was very tough for families around the country, and I sat and talked to many, many families who were experiencing that and felt dejected. So I felt like we should bring some sense of pride back to the country, and also abroad. We didn't have the best of names at the time because, you know, we were seen to be greedy in those years of the Celtic Tiger, and now we were paying the price for that. So anyway, for those reasons, I felt like that, not just me, but the people we were able to mobilise, such a huge amount of people around 2003 and achieve so much with not a great deal except goodwill and effort and a willingness to become involved. I felt like, well, maybe we could do that in Ireland now and make people be proud of what they have. And things are cyclical. Things will change. Things will get better in Ireland. That sort of positive attitude, I felt like I could mobilise the people around me, as had happened.
Did you think you were going to win when you set out on the road?
Well, who knows, Sean? I know you can't say that. I had no idea I was going to win. I mean, I was up against it. There were, what, 7 or 8 people? I can't remember.
You were one
now.
Of eight.
One of eight. A lot of people to be in that race. Mm. And it became more and more difficult, obviously. But you know what? As I said, it was a positive experience. It did harden me up. And in many ways, you know, the challenges that I had to face afterwards in the role of chief executive, I think that whole experience helped me a great deal in dealing with the governors and the DeSantises of this world. You know, it just, yeah, it helped.
It's quite the slog, a campaign like that, and you're not the first and presumably won't be the last who remember as maybe a kind of a searing experience. Were there a moment or two when maybe, you know, another poll came out and things were looking fairly unhopeful, that's, God, why did I get into this?
I suppose there's always a sense of, you know, gosh, you know, why am I doing this? Why am I putting myself through this? Of course, that's natural. I think that's natural. So there is. But anyway, I was in it and I was determined to keep going. And so I did. So, yeah, the outcome was the outcome. But I'm not one of those people that dwell in the past and look back and think, oh, gosh, you know, I was hard done by, or I was this, that and the other. It's not. It was a positive experience. I learned a lot. I think it helped me now in the job I had for the last 10 years. And, you know, Ireland has come through great times now.
And you're
there's
back.
No need for anybody like me to think about standing.
Yeah. Any unfilled or unfulfilled ambitions at this stage?
I'm just started to learn French. I did French in school. I was pretty reasonable at it at the time, but of course, you know, you're not practicing French, so you've a lot to learn. So I've started that, and I'm obviously interested in a couple of places in the world that I haven't got around to visit, or that I did visit in my role as in Special Olympics, but thought I'd love to come back, because obviously when you go for work, as you probably know from many travels yourself, it's not the same as going on vacation or exploring. So those are things. I'd like to play more golf than I was able to play for the past 10 years. I'd enjoy that. And My grandchildren and my family, you know, I feel that there were times when they were neglected for one reason and another because I was so busy at work. Really, no matter what role I played in the organisation, whether it was as a volunteer or as a staff member, the work never ceases, and it's still, there is still so much more to be done. There's so much to be done in the area of disability as well here in Ireland. You know, you see all these campaigns now for what's going to happen when elderly parents that are looking after people with disability, their sons and daughters, what are they going to do? What provisions are going to be made for them? You know, they just don't know. And they're in, you know, many organisations being set up. So it's still challenging, but you know what? Change is sometimes slow, but we, as long as we can see progression in life, I think that's what's important.
Mary Davis, thank you so much indeed for your insights, and thank you very much, and the very best of luck with all your future endeavours and lots of happiness. And you can find more insights with Sean O'Rourke on the RT Radio Player or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening, Mary. Thank you again.
Thank you. Thanks, Sean. Delighted to be here with you.